The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hi everybody, and welcome to Outward, Slate's show about all your LGBT queries. I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and I am dealing, with some really serious post-spooky season sadness this week. So I'm glad to have the show to record to be with all of my friends to make me feel better.
Aw. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a senior writer at Slate. And Brian, did you see any ghosts this Halloween?
I saw a few.
I know you're a huge believer and lover of ghosts.
No real ones, but a lot of cute little ones running around my neighborhood, which was really, really adorable to see. Yeah.
That's sweet.
Halloween is for the kids. Just for those wondering, Jules was not able to record with us today, but she will be with us later in the show when we get into our topic that we have for you today. We have a very cool, very nerdy show. We'll be talking with Jeopardy champion and trans trailblazer Amy Schneider about her new memoir In the Form of a Question. I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since Christina pitched the idea, because I missed Amy's run the first time around. But Christina, you've been a fan like since the beginning, right?
Oh, yeah. I think it was almost exactly 2 years ago. I was visiting my parents and they watched Jeopardy every night.
Right.
And so when I'm with them, we also watch Jeopardy together. I lived with them for a few weeks during the pandemic and was sort of like our little tradition together. They think I'm really good at it, so it's a huge ego boost. And Amy Schneider was on when I was watching in 2021. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned her partner or her girlfriend. And I was like, I think she's trans. And I was just kind of like, I'm so glad my parents are here watching this incredible trans woman win, wipe the floor with the other people on Jeopardy. And especially knowing how popular Jeopardy is, I was just stunned by A, how good she was on the show, and also how like she was bringing trans visibility into a lot of American homes that probably aren't always tuning into queer media. You know, Of course, there are those of us queers that love the quiz shows, but Jeopardy has a really wide and diverse demographic. So when I heard that she wrote a memoir, I just crossed my fingers and hoped that she would agree to come on our show. I'm so glad she did. We had a really fun conversation, and I really hope that our listeners pick up the book and read it. We barely touch on a fraction of the stuff she writes about in the book so hilariously and charmingly. It's a must read of the season, I'd say.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was so blown away by Amy's mind and just her like amazing personality and just the way that she talked about this experience. So let's get to it. We'll be back with all of that and more after a quick break.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by CarMax. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because CarMax believes you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car they sell has CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive. CarMax. The way car buying should be. Start shopping now at CarMax.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, this week we have a special guest who I've been wanting to have on the show for basically 2 years. Amy Schneider became a Jeopardy champion and darling of American living rooms in fall 2021, winter 2022. She was on a tear. Her 40-game winning streak was the second longest of any player Jeopardy has ever seen, and she ended up winning $1.3 million, more money than any other woman in the history of the show. And I think only 3 other people have ever crossed the $1 million mark. Devoted listeners might remember that Amy was actually my pride 1 month during her streak back in late 2021, because I had watched a few episodes when I was at my parents' house. And in the part of the show where each contestant shares a fun fact, Amy said that with her winnings, she and her partner Genevieve wanted to buy a house with 2 baths in it because they both loved taking baths so much. It was so gay, so good. Anyway, Amy has just come out with a sparkling memoir titled In the Form of a Question. And it is, I would say, a remarkably open and revealing book for a new queer icon. Amy explores not only her childhood and her education, but also her recreational drug use, her sexual history, and the dissolution of her first marriage. And she writes with great candor and nuance about how she came to an understanding of her trans identity. So in the book, we get to follow along with her as she explores and settles into that identity in the years leading up to her Jeopardy streak. I don't know about you guys, but I absolutely sped through this book. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have Amy on the show this month. Amy Schneider, welcome to Outward.
Oh, thanks for having me. And quick correction, it was even gayer than that. What we wanted was a bathtub that was big enough for both of us.
Oh, wow.
When I watched it on TV, I was like, I cannot believe they let me say that.
I'm so glad they did. So before we get into the book, where are you on that big bath thing? Is that in the works? Has that happened?
It has not happened. It turns out it is very difficult to buy a house. And, you know, especially because, like, having a bunch of money does not get you a mortgage if you don't have, like, a W-2 income. That's just been a whole adventure. But, you know, it's still the dream for sure.
I know. That's homophobic. That's really
homophobic.
Don't
they know who you are? You should just be able to waltz in.
So, Amy, so much of this book is about your journey to self-confidence, seeing yourself as desirable. And it seems like figuring out that you were trans was a part of that. But also, now you're famous. And you write in the book about, you know, all the new avenues that's opened up for you, such that, this is a quote, I can imagine myself as a hipster-approved queer celebrity. And dare I say it, a sex symbol, which, affirmative. But what else can you tell us about how this sort of wild and unexpected turn in your life has affected your understanding of yourself?
Yeah, I think, you know, when it all started, you know, this was not something I expected. You know, I went on Jeopardy, thought I would have some fun and that would be it. And then even before the episodes aired, I knew it would be big, but I didn't realize how big it was going to be. And so I definitely started out with a fair amount of imposter syndrome, essentially, like, you know, all, you know, getting invited to the White House and, you know, all these crazy places I never expected to be. And even starting out writing the book, I felt very much like, who wants to hear about, you know, little old me and that sort of thing. But as I've settled into it, I've sort of realized that, you know, yeah, you know, am I lucky to be in the position I am? Sure, but that doesn't mean I don't deserve it. You know, people are responding to something real about me. And, you know, beyond that, you know, trans people don't get a platform all that often. And so I have a responsibility not to be too self-deprecating about it and to take this opportunity and, you know, be out there and be visible and represent a community that, you know, there's not that many of us.
And even more than that, I mean, just being on Jeopardy, which, by the way, Jeopardy viewership spiked during her streak because everyone wanted to see, you know, this woman who was breaking records and just absolutely killing it. And I feel like given Jeopardy's demographics, I mean, you probably came into the living rooms of a lot of Americans who don't normally watch trans people on TV. They're not watching like Pose or something like that. Obviously, you knew that going into the show that you'd be streamed to, you know, many mm-hmm. millions of viewers. How did you arrive at the decision of how to present yourself as a trans person on, you know, one of the most watched shows in America?
Yeah, you know, I think that I struggled with that a bit in the sort of lead up to it. And one of the things in particular I struggled with was my voice, which was the thing I felt a lot of dysphoria about. Mm. You know, just because if nothing else, like I get called sir on the phone a lot, you know, that's far more common than anybody misgendering me in person. And so I really considered, like, did I want to really, you know, pitch up my voice and try to have a more feminine voice on the show? You know, I was kind of confident about the rest of myself because I knew they would have somebody like doing my hair and makeup and all that sort of thing. But that was what I was worried about. And I sort of decided at the last minute not to, because really for no other reason than that it just felt like a distraction. And, you know, I wanted to be focused on the game and not how I was coming across. And I had just sort of told myself in general, like, just go on and be yourself. If you're trying to be fake, then, you know, not only will it make you less likely to win, but it also, you know, that's something I could fail at. Whereas if I'm being myself, then however people react to it is how they react to it, but I can live with it. Oh. And so that was sort of what I was, my philosophy going into it. I certainly, especially once I won a few games, realized that, like, okay, I'm going to be a, you know, well-known trans person on some level at this point. And so I was certainly conscious of trying to, you know, put my best face forward and represent the community well. But I was not, you know, I wasn't trying too hard. Again, I was just trying to focus on the game. I think it helped a lot that there was no studio audience at the time.
Oh,
and
nice.
So I was really able to separate, like, how I was coming across from playing the game.
Yeah. Amy, as we get into the book a little bit, I wanted to give our listeners a sense of how it's organized, because I think it's a really interesting choice that you made. The chapters are all, as the title would suggest, in the form of a question, just like Jeopardy. But you say in the book that part of that is about you organize it sort of according to neurodivergence, specifically ADD. Can you explain a little bit about how you came to the format of that you wrote and why that worked well for you as a memoir sort of technique? Because memoirs are hard to do and hard to organize.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I did it, you know, I had never thought about writing a whole book before, and it was a very imposing thought. And so I broke it up into, you know, a bunch of kind of independent essays, just because that was the only way I could, you know, sort of manage it. And I also, when I was starting out, again, with that sort of imposter syndrome before, I didn't intend it to be as much of a memoir as it was. I wanted to kind of have some non-memoir things in there, some like different, like, I don't know, more like culture writing or philosophical ideas or things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, one, I sort of got more comfortable with the idea that it was okay for me to write a memoir. And two, that other stuff was like harder and the memoir stuff came more easily. And my deadlines kept passing and I had to sort of focus on it for that reason. But yeah. And I think I was sort of happy with the way it came out. You know, sort of organically. I think somebody I was working with called it like a mixtape, which I thought was a good metaphor for it. Yeah.
And the footnotes too, to me, struck me as, I mean, part of what makes the book so fun and feel so full of life and personality and feel, I don't know how you feel, but it felt like true to you, because we get to see sort of the little asides that are sort of coming into your head or a little more context about what you're talking about. And it also struck me that
It gets spicy in the footnotes, everybody. So
oh,
don't
incredibly
skip
spicy.
Them. It's spicy. It's hot down there, so don't miss that.
But it also made me think, you know, for somebody who has ADD and who is, you know, working sort of like using their neurodivergence as a secret weapon, I think you sort of describe it that way. Footnotes seem like a great way to do that, too.
Absolutely. And I mean, that was the point at which, because I'd wanted to do it. I mean, it's definitely a David Foster Wallace influence for sure. I mean, that's, you know, where I came across that format. And I always loved that. But I'd sort of been resisting doing it, partly because I sort of felt like my editor wouldn't like it, which may not have been true. But when I was writing the chapter about ADD, I was like, well, I have to do it in this chapter, because that's the whole point is, you know, that is the thing about my brain is it doesn't stay in one track. It is constantly, you know, jumping into different directions. And when I'm writing, like, you know, every few sentences, I'll be like, well, there's two different directions I want to go with this. Mm-hmm. And without the footnotes, it was really like slowing me down and paralyzing me. And I would end up with a bunch of like nested parenthetical asides that were impossible to read. And so, yeah, doing it in that chapter and my editor liking it and giving me the green light to just go ahead with it, it really like liberated me and made it, you know, made everything else like come easier. That definitely, I felt that was kind of the moment at which I sort of felt like, okay, I know what this book is at this point, once I started with the footnotes.
Cool. That's fascinating. I mean, because I don't know. I mean, let me just say, as a trans woman who's very invested in my brain, I, you know, had all sorts of reactions and identifications reading along. And one of the ways I was sort of processing those kinds of like constant twists and turns is also that, like, I don't know how else to say this, like, Amy, you're so reasonable. Like you're so honest. You're so careful to not necessarily kind of just always check your own thoughts or beliefs, but to really explore, you know, what you're talking about, explore beliefs or stories from multiple angles that really connect immediately to the reader. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't at all sacrifice being witty or really wise or having brilliant insight, which I just kind of love. And I guess I'm kind of curious to what extent that for you is also maybe conditioned. I mean, one, maybe by being, you know, a public trans figure. I mean, I know just like the intensity of what it feels like to be a trans woman in this culture that sort of obsessively consumes and, you know, aggresses us is that like you feel like you have to fact check and caveat every single thing you're going to say just sort of defensively without realizing it. But it also might be something that I imagine, if I'm not projected, you know, comes from, you know, early on life experiences. There's a point where you explained, speaking of footnotes, you mentioned that, you know, pleasing grownups was sort of a skill of yours as a kid, and the footnote then adds, I'm still pretty good at it. And I was like, oh no, me too. I'm sort of curious, like, is that also this kind of, sort of coping mechanism developed, you know, to sort of be in the world as a trans girl and a trans woman that then kind of you can sort of leverage to put to ends that are more satisfying ultimately?
Yeah, I think that those are definitely factors. I think on the trans side of it, I sort of think of it as I spent my whole life baffled by the things that I was and wasn't allowed to do. Like, you know, why was I not allowed to read the American Girl books? These things made no sense to me. And so I've always been like just trying to figure out what everybody wants from me and how to play along by these rules that I didn't understand. So I think that was definitely part of what was going on with that. But yeah, I think that, you know, then since coming out, I think that, yeah, you are always kind of aware that, you know, you exist. I'm a walking political debate in a certain way. And that's always sort of a hazard of, you know, being out in public and especially now being famous. And also, you know, I've been on Twitter for a long time. I see so many people yelling at each other. And I want to actually have a chance at reaching people. I know that people are going to be reading this book that are not already in alignment with me politically. And I want to communicate with them and connect with them and hopefully change some people's minds rather than just feeling self-righteous.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, but we'll be back with more from Amy right after the break.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Reading this book, I kept thinking of the audience. I mean, I'm sure there will be a lot of people who read this book who are Jeopardy fans and maybe don't really know that much about the book going into it, but really liked it on the show. I feel like you will have snuck some really sexual and subversive stuff into the hands of like a fair number of of small C and maybe even large C conservative Jeopardy fans. Mm-hmm. I want to know how you thought about the audience while you were writing the book, and also how you came to feel comfortable sharing parts of your life, part of your mind that a lot of other people might have felt kind of squeamish about putting on paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely at these book signings, some of the people that come up and I'm like, oh, I'm excited to read the book. I'm like, you may be in there for a surprise.
A good one.
Yeah, but that was, you know, certainly intentional. I think in terms of feeling comfortable with it, I'm just sort of am comfortable with it. I just, you know, kind of an open person. And certainly the one of the feelings about it was when I first became famous and, you know, Jeopardy is very wholesome and all this sort of thing, there was this part of my mind was like, oh no, what if people find out about all the sex and drugs? Huh. And so putting it out there is just like, now I don't have to worry about it. Like, it's not a secret anymore. But also it was about, I felt this sort of, I was afraid that my sort of wholesome image as being the first trans person that a lot of people had accepted would then become an unfair standard that they would hold other trans people to.
Oh, interesting.
Like, it's like, I'm not transphobic, but why can't you just be like that nice Amy lady?
Sure.
And so I wanted to, and you know, these sorts of like sex and drugs, you know, are a lot of trans people go through this sort of thing. You know, like being trans for many people means that the sort of moral framework you were raised in is actively destructive to you, and so you wind up going out and, you know, being pretty experimental with your life. And so I wanted to show that you can have those experiences and still be successful and a nice person on TV and all of those sorts of things. So yeah, that was my thinking about, I mean, the audience I was thinking was two people. One, the people that had never known a trans person before and wanting to show a sort of complete picture of one. And two, what were the things that I would have liked to know about being trans in the years before I came out? Like, you know, talking about a lot of the myths that held me back and, you know, hopefully, you know, helping some people out.
Speaking of that, actually, one of the most moving and kind of actually personally resonant chapters for me was about the Boy Scouts, Boy Scouts camp. Because I was a Boy Scout, I actually went all the way to Eagle and kind of did it in a similar way to you, because I was told to do it and sort of silently hated it and you know, went all the way to the end for my dad and whatnot. you know, you write that you found going to being in the Boy Scouts and then going to scout camp specifically for the summer, an opportunity to learn valuable lessons about how to be the man I was doomed to become. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that experience and why you thought it was such a definitive moment sort of in your personal development and also on your gender journey.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I had from childhood just preferred hanging out with girls, you know, like on the playground and whatever. And you know, at that particular time, you know, middle school, the right. sort of beginning of puberty and things like that. First of all of a sudden, like, gender integration was not allowed socially. And, you know, my body is betraying me and all these sorts of things. I mean, it's just an awkward time for everyone.
Yeah.
And then to have the sort of social companionship I prefer taken away from me and thrust into this all-male world where, you know, those sort of unspoken rules I was talking about before were everywhere. And, you know, maleness is so heavily policed in yeah. our society that it's very limited boundaries of what you're allowed to do and how you're allowed to be. And the Boy Scouts exacerbated that. You know, I'm not an outdoorsy person. I am not, you know, that's just not the sort of things I enjoy. I like sitting around and reading a book, and my scoutmaster did not think that was a good use of a scout's time. That is not what the Boy Scouts is all about. And so it was, and as I said, I wanted to be pleasing adults. I wanted to be the good kid that, you know, was excelling at everything. And this was just something that I could not possibly excel in. And so it was really, I was stuck in this paradox of not being able to do the thing I thought I was best at.
I have to ask you about Daria. Yeah. not just because I'm also a fan. But I think, like, for me, this chapter where you write about, you know, actually your shifting relationship to that show, mm-hmm. I think is so emblematic of this kind of larger theme I think we're talking about here, which is, you know, first of all, I don't know, I think there's could be a lot of pressure on trans people who do become famous to sort of carry the cultural weight of, I don't know, just sort of truisms or tropes that, like, we've never signed off on. And one of those is this kind of, like, crass version of representation matters, where it's like, in the past, all trans people were sad because there weren't, you know, Amy Schneider's on Jeopardy. But now that there are, all trans children will be happy and grow up and be free. And it's like, that's neither of those pictures make really any sense. And one of the things that I love and also really relate to is you're very candid and thoughtful about, you know, just because you're a child who doesn't have the language or wasn't handed a concept like transgender, you know, in childhood or adolescence, doesn't mean you just sit around, you know, completely cut off from the world, totally miserable and confused. Like, you indirectly extract meaning from the culture that you live in. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it seemed to me like Daria is one of those places. And it's just also great. You know, I just love the way you write about the show. So could you share with us a little bit of, like, how did that show feel important to you when you first started watching it, and how and what some of the lessons that it kind of taught you as you became a super fan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think you're totally right. I mean, I think that I certainly always did have, you know, female role models, right? Whether fictional or otherwise, you know, those were the people that I looked up to, however semi-subconsciously. And Daria was certainly one of them. I mean, you know, she was exactly, I mean, we're essentially the same age, the right. same sort of, you know, very, like, sarcastic, standoffish, you know, intellectual. And so it was somebody that I could, like, completely, completely identify with. And, you know, it was a time in my life when I was feeling very isolated. I didn't really have any friends in college for various reasons. And, you know, Daria certainly also feels isolated and feel like she has no friends except for Jane. And the way in which she matures over the series is so subtle. She doesn't change exactly. None of the characters really change. But they're just very subtly deepened and made more complex. And I think one of the amazing things I've discovered about the show is that all of the side characters, who are so cartoonish and one note, they each have like one character trait. And yet, as you get to know them over the series, there's all these little moments that make you realize that despite their one note portrayal, they have their own full story going on, their own internal life. And they're all more complex than they appear, while still, you know, it's not that the one note is wrong, but that there's just more to them and there's more to everybody. I think one of the things that happens over the show is that Daria realizes she has more friends than she thinks. And it made me realize that I had more friends than I thought. That just, you know, I felt at the time and still have a tendency to feel that if somebody is not my absolute super close friend that I share everything with, then we're not really friends and they probably don't even really like me. But Daria helped me, you know, tone that worry down a little bit.
I also wanted to ask about another one of your loves, tarot, which on another recent episode, we talked about this new queer paranormal TV show, and there's a tarot specialist in it. And, you know, you grew up extremely Catholic, as did I. And tarot, it feels like maybe sort of came in place of that and provided sort of a different structure of finding meaning in things. But also you write about it as just a great way to meet people. How did you come to, how did tarot come to have, you know, such a big role in your life?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for one thing, I think when you think about it, you know, organized religion also largely functions for a lot of people as a way to meet people, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, I think, you know, tarot is just, you know, my ex-wife got into it, and so it was just sort of around, and I'd always found it kind of vaguely interesting. And so I read the 78 Degrees of Wisdom, the book that got a lot of people into it. And then, you know, I started doing it for myself and for other people, and it's just sort of a fun, like, little improv game. Like, the cards come up, and then you have to, like, come up with a story on the spot that is sort of coherent with these random cards with their weird images on them. But what I found pretty quickly was that it always seemed to work. Like, when I was doing it for other people, they virtually without exception would be like, wow, that was really, no, I see what it's saying there. That was really helpful, or all of these sorts of things. And I was like, I've just made that up off the top of my head. It's just so weird that it keeps working. But I think it's just a well-designed tool for that. And so it, you know, it was especially at a time when I was single and living alone and didn't have a lot of sort of human interaction. It was a way for me to go out to a bar and put it out there. And if anybody wanted to come up and ask about it, I'd give them a reading. And we would, you know, in this very brief interaction, talk about some kind of like really stuff, you know, meaningful stuff that was important to them. Not even necessarily in detail. I didn't always know what we were talking about, but it was a way to like actually have a real conversation without any real commitment. You know, we would have this conversation that could potentially get a little bit intimate, and then I'd be like, all right, bye, you know, thanks. And that would be it. And so it was, that was really one of the main things I got out of it. But it's also just for myself. I mean, I found it helpful at times writing this book and other times. Like when I get stuck, that's when tarot is useful, whatever it is I'm stuck on, because it shakes up your brain and gives you a new way to look at things.
I love that you shared that you use it as part of your writing process, because I do the same thing. And listeners, if you need another, you know, another reason to pick up this book, please know that Amy gives a wonderful introduction to the major arcana and sort of just a great intro to how tarot works in general. So you get that, you know, for free in the book as well. It's very good.
Yeah, multi-purpose.
Multi-purpose.
Yeah.
Something for everyone.
What direction do you see your life taking now? I mean, it feels like Jeopardy and your fame kind of changed everything for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I feel very uncertain about right now, having, you know, just gotten through this book launch that had been sort of, you know, taking up all of my brain for the past few months. I certainly would love to keep writing. I loved writing this book, despite hating writing this book. and it's, you know, I definitely feel like I have a lot more to say on a variety of topics. I certainly want to, again, now that I've kind of got this off of my plate, I'm thinking about how to be a little more active around trans issues. I'm, you know, there's certainly, you know, in California, you know, it's such a liberal state, but there's a lot of conservative areas and a lot of local school boards that have been kind of hijacked by some pretty hateful people, and wanting to sort of do my best to bring more exposure to that and do what I can to help, you know, trans kids in particular. I think it's so upsetting to me that, you know, children are being targeted because they have, you know, like no power at all to fight back. And it's, you know, it's something I feel so powerless about, but I have more power than, you know, most people. And so I want to try to start using that more.
Yeah. I'm so glad to hear you want to keep writing too, because honestly, I just think you're such an engaging, hilarious, and thoughtful writer all at once. And more broadly, I think one of the just beautiful things that transpires over the course of the book is, I think you really break down in this totally non-didactic way the kind of canned image of success that our culture uses to tokenize, you know, people from minority or marginalized communities, where it's like, well, you know, one exceptional, perfect, saintly, suffering trans woman gets to be in the spotlight. And it's like, hey, actually, no, you know, there is no one kind of trans woman, but also, like, you can be someone who, like, has a really interesting, exciting, sexy, queer life, you know, who enjoys psychedelics, who, you know, has done this and that, and still be an incredible Jeopardy champion, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think that there's something really beautiful and almost poetic about the way that comes across, you know, in reading the book. And I just really appreciate you kind of making that case so flawlessly and seamlessly, because it's something I find myself so hungry for in all of these supposed culture wars we're living through. So there was not a question about that. I was just me shamelessly fangirly.
I mean, I'm not going to complain about that. I think that, you know, it is something that I've thought about. You know, I was sort of surprised by how many times I've heard the story along the lines of, you know, my father or whatever saw you on Jeopardy, and like they sort of, it's that's sort of what got through to them about trans people and all of that. Right. And I think it's because, you know, I wasn't on Jeopardy as a trans person. That wasn't, you know, partly to Jeopardy's credit. It was something that they never had any interest in, you know, highlighting any more than I wanted them to. And, you know, I wasn't there in a way that sort of triggered people's sort of defensiveness. I wasn't there in a sort of political sense. And I think that's, you know, something that's why I was able to kind of like slip through people's, you know, kind of get around people's defenses and get through to them in a way that other, you know, trans representatives are not able to do, because they're positioned in such a different way.
Yeah, totally. Well, Amy, it was such a pleasure to watch you on Jeopardy. I'm so grateful that you were able to join us on the show. And thank you so much for your book. We loved it.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for having me.
Again, Amy's book is called In the Form of a Question. It comes highly recommended by Outward.
Yeah.
Seriously, like, truly my favorite book that I've read in a long time. I just, like, I think I'm going to read it again.
Aww. It was so enjoyable. Yeah, it was really, really enjoyable.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. No, I eventually became very proud of it, you know, when it first done. I was just like, oh, here's, you know, da-da-da. But once I got a little space, I was like, yeah, no, I'm really happy with how it came out.
Good. And I hope you're able to bask in the book tour part of it and everyone telling you how great it was.
I do love people telling me how great it is.
And then get that bath time.
Yeah.
Deserve it.
All right, that is all we have for today's episode of Outward. As always, please send us your feedback and topic ideas to outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook or X. at Slate Outward. Just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Working, and you will never, ever hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more about that, go to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show was produced by Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app. Tell your friends, family, everyone you love about it, and rate and review the show so others can join in on the fun. Until next time, stay gay, everybody.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.